When you're driving in an unfamiliar city, right, and your GPS is just absolutely convinced that you need to go straight ahead.
No, yeah. Even if going straight means literally driving your car directly into a lake.
Right. And the truly bizarre part is that the sheer force of habit actually makes you hesitate. Like for a split second, you actually consider following the little screen instead of your own eyes.
Because we trust that internal map so much. And I mean, it is a perfect metaphor for the human condition, really. That
Yeah.
tension or that stubborn refusal to believe what the water is telling us is at the core of so much of our struggle.
Welcome in, everyone. Our mission for today's deep dive is to figure out how to stop fighting reality like that. How to put down the broken GPS and, learn to read the actual currents instead.
Yes, and we will be unpacking some incredible insights from the RAFT to Freedom program to do this.
Just to give you a bit of context, if you're new to this, the RAFT program is built around a really practical acronym. It stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feel, Train, R-A-F-T, RAFT.
And today we are zooming in on a very specific moment in that framework. We're looking closely at Chapter 57, which focuses on a concept called skillful perspective.
Which marks the beginning of the train stage, right?
Exactly. It's the very first factor of their middle way program.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can steer our raft out of a compulsion or, navigate away from a damaging old pattern, we have to actually see where we are.
You have to. If
Yeah.
you don't know you're heading for the lake, you have absolutely no reason to turn the wheel. Skillful perspective is, well, it's like the navigator's eyeglass.
I like that. The navigator's eyeglass.
Yeah, because you cannot steer effectively if you are misreading the sea. And to understand why we need this eyeglass, we first have to understand the core problem. The text uses a pretty heavy but accurate phrase for it. They call it existential dissonance.
Wait, existential dissonance. Let's break that jargon down a bit, because that sounds like something from a graduate philosophy
It
seminar.
does sound academic, I know.
Yeah. But imagine it describes a very common feeling. What does that actually look like for you and me in our day-to-day lives?
It's basically the profound exhaustion that happens when your inner map constantly clashes with reality. Think of it as a massive energy drain.
Like leaving apps open on your phone.
Exactly like that. Your inner map insists on certain rules. It says things like, I shouldn't have to feel this anxiety, or I absolutely need this specific thing to happen so I can be happy.
Right.
Meanwhile, reality just keeps operating by its own rules,
Yeah.
right? It shows you over and over, actually, everything changes, including this anxiety, or actually, following this compulsion is causing you significant harm.
So the exhaustion doesn't just come from the raw facts of our lives. Like the pain of a hard day is one thing, but the real exhaustion comes from the constant daily friction of arguing with those facts.
Yes.
We're basically getting mad at the lake for being in the way of our digital map.
That friction is the dissonance. And the text points out how we constantly treat fragile, changing things as if they were totally solid. We treat a passing mood, like a random Tuesday afternoon slump, as if it is our fixed permanent identity forever.
Oh, wow. I do that all the time.
We all do. We treat what is constantly changing as if it will stay the exact same.
Knowing how often I do that myself, I don't know, it's really easy to feel a bit judged by that realization. Like I'm just failing at being a person.
And that is a crucial trap to avoid right from the jump. Skillful perspective is not a moral judgment at all. It is not about beating yourself up for having the wrong map.
Okay, that's a relief.
Yeah, these habits of misseeing reality, they're deeply, profoundly human tendencies. It's not a punishment. It is simply a gentle correction.
Yeah.
It's about aligning the mind with the basic pattern of things, which the text referred to as the Dhamma.
The basic pattern of things, that makes sense. But moving from theory to practice here, since skillful perspective isn't just, trying harder to be a good person, what is the actual mechanism?
Right, how do we build it?
Yeah, how do we build this navigator's eyeglass so we can actually see the Dhamma clearly?
So the RAFT program breaks skillful perspective down into three essential pillars. And we need all three for it to hold any weight. The first pillar is responsibility, which fundamentally means understanding that our actions have consequences.
Okay, let me pause you there, actually, because I want to push back on that word a little bit.
Sure.
If I am having a really hard week and I have a wobble or a flip into an old pattern, isn't responsibility just a polite, therapeutic word for blaming myself?
I am so glad you brought that up. It is a very common misinterpretation, and it's vital to separate the two. Blame is a moral judgment, right? It says you are fundamentally flawed.
Right.
Responsibility in this context is pure objective cause and effect. It's physics.
But wait, physics doesn't carry guilt. Like when I slip back into a bad habit, I feel immense guilt and shame. How do I actually strip the heavy emotion out of this idea of cause and effect? It feels almost impossible to just view a personal failing as physics.
You strip the emotion out by recognizing the actual boundaries of your control. We do not control the weather, the waves, or the fact that a craving has arisen in the mind. The guilt comes from assuming we should be able to control all of that. The responsibility only applies to what we choose to do next with the craving.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. When we act from craving, the results usually hurt. When we act from honesty and restraint, it steadies the raft. It's really just about acknowledging your agency in the present moment without condemning your character for the past.
I see the distinction there. It's the difference between saying, I am a terrible driver for ending up near this lake, versus saying, if I press the accelerator right now, the car will get wet.
Perfectly said.
One is an identity verdict, and the other is just assessing the mechanics of the situation.
Exactly. And that leads directly into the second pillar. Because if you take responsibility for an action, you inevitably have to ask, well, why did I make that choice in the first place? Choices don't just happen in a vacuum. So the second pillar is pattern. This is the understanding that conditions shape experience.
So a slip or a sudden surge of a compulsion isn't just some random attack from the universe.
Right. Cravings, shame, confusion, they do not just drop out of a clear blue sky. They have specific conditions. And this is incredibly liberating because it completely destroys the idea that you are a fixed, broken identity.
Yeah.
You aren't just weak or flawed. What we think of as our self is actually a workable process. The text refers to this as selfing, basically turning the concept of self from a noun into a verb. You are a living pattern.
If you view yourself as a noun, like a broken thing, there is nothing to fix. But if you view yourself as a verb, a pattern of behaviors reacting to conditions,
right,
then you can actually start tweaking the variables. You can tend to the conditions that create the pattern.
Which brings us to the third pillar, which gives all of this effort a purpose. The third pillar is freedom.
Freedom.
Yes, the understanding that suffering can actually ease. And to explain this, the text points to Gautama, the Buddha, and his four realizations.
Let's spend some time on those because I don't want to just rattle them off as a quick list.
Yeah.
How do these four realizations actually work to ease suffering?
They're structured almost like a medical diagnosis. The first realization is simply acknowledging there is stress or suffering. Now, why is just saying there is stress liberating?
Why?
Because it validates your reality. Instead of gaslighting yourself by saying, I shouldn't be upset, you just acknowledge the storm is real.
You stop fighting the existence of the lake.
Precisely. The second realization is that this stress has causes. It's not a permanent curse. It is the result of conditions, which are usually rooted in our craving for things to be different than they currently are.
Mm.
The third realization is the real turning point. It can ease. Because it is caused by conditions, if you change the conditions, the suffering literally has to lessen.
That is huge. It moves pain from being a permanent character flaw to basically a temporary solvable equation.
Exactly. And the fourth realization is that there is a practical path to follow to make that easing happen.
Right. When you hold those three pillars together, responsibility, pattern, and freedom, it seems like it would completely dismantle the overwhelming authority of a compulsion.
It really does.
Because in the moment, an old pattern feels like this massive, undeniable truth. Yeah. But viewed through this lens, it's just a conditional pattern that you have the power to influence.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it raises a really important question about how we interpret these ancient ideas today, especially if we want to use them practically. The RAFT program leans heavily on secular interpretations.
Interesting. Like what?
For instance, the secular Dharma teacher, Stephen Batchelor, he prefers the word perspective over the traditional translation of right view.
Oh, that is an important shift. Because right view sounds very dogmatic. Like there is a strict right way and a punishable wrong way. And if you get it wrong, you just fail the test.
Batchelor argues exactly that. He says, view sounds like a doctrine you have to force yourself to believe. Perspective, on the other hand, is a vantage point. It's something you hold, you test in your own life, and you revise it based on new information. It is a tool, not a religion.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because if it's a perspective we can test, we get to observe our own daily data. We start reading what the text calls the menu of the mind.
Yes.
And this is where we see cause and effect in real time. Throughout the day, we are always feeding something. We're either feeding the storm or we're feeding freedom.
That concept of the mental menu is so powerful. what are the mechanisms there? Like, how do we actually feed the storm without realizing it?
Well, the storm thrives on very specific diets. Fantasy, for example, feeds craving. If you sit there vividly imagining the thing you want, romanticizing the old pattern, you are just pouring gasoline on the fire. Repetition feeds resentment. If you just play that argument you had with your boss on a loop in your head all day, you are keeping the anger entirely alive in the present. And secrecy absolutely feeds shame.
That last one is critical. Why does secrecy feed shame?
Because shame requires isolation to survive. It needs you to believe you are the only one uniquely broken enough to do what you did. The moment you speak it aloud to someone you trust, you break the condition of isolation, and the shame begins to starve.
That makes total sense. And on the other side of the menu, we have what feeds freedom. It's surprisingly practical, grounded stuff. Sleep feeds freedom.
Sleep?
Yeah, because an exhausted brain cannot maintain skillful perspective. Honesty feeds it. Good company feeds it. Telling the exact truth about the consequences of your actions rather than minimizing them, that builds the raft.
I want you, listening right now, to apply this to your own life. Think about your choices over the last 24 hours. The conversations you had, the media you consumed, the thoughts you allowed to loop. Were those ingredients nourishing your freedom, or were they quietly nourishing the storm?
It is a confronting audit to do, but an essential one. We cultivate this perspective not by adopting grand philosophies, but by shifting how we handle those mundane daily moments.
Okay, all of this theory is incredibly insightful. But let's get into the trenches. What happens when you are in the middle of a totally chaotic day? You're stressed, you're running late, the storm is brewing, and your perspective is shrinking by the second. The RAFT program provides three specific daily protocols for when things get rocky.
Yes, and the first one is brilliant for its ability to de-escalate the nervous system. It's called the conditions protocol. It is the deliberate movement from a verdict to an investigation.
Verdicts are so dangerous because of how fast they happen. You make a mistake or you have a slip and the inner critic just slams the gavel. I'm weak. I'm a failure. I'll never get this right.
Yeah.
When you deliver a verdict like that, what happens neurologically? It literally shuts down your prefrontal cortex. It traps you in a state of threat.
A verdict is a dead end, but the conditions protocol invites you to investigate instead. You replace the heavy gavel with a genuine question. What conditions were in place? Like, was I hungry? Was I incredibly lonely? Was I physically exhausted?
Seeing those conditions doesn't excuse what happened, but it makes it manageable. If your verdict is, I am a fundamental failure, there is no medicine for that on earth.
Right.
But if your investigation reveals, I was running on 4 hours of sleep and felt totally isolated, well, rest and connection become your medicine. A condition gives you a physical handle to actually fix the problem.
Protocol number two builds on that clarity. It's called the basic pattern check. When you are feeling overwhelmed by an emotion or a craving, you ask yourself three questions about whatever you're experiencing. Question one, is this permanent or is it changing?
Why is looking at impermanence so effective in the middle of a crisis?
Because a compulsion relies on the illusion of permanence. It tricks your brain into believing the craving will last forever unless you give in to it. By closely observing that the sensation is actually shifting, cresting, and changing minute by minute, you break the illusion.
Wow.
Question two is, can this fully satisfy me? Can this action provide lasting peace?
And if we are honest, the answer is almost always no. Even the most intensely desired things only provide temporary relief before the cycle just starts again.
Exactly. Finally, question three, is this really me, or is it just an experience arising and passing in a web of conditions? These questions act as anchors. They gently pull you out of the existential dissonance and drop you back into alignment with reality.
Which sets up the third protocol. And this one might be my favorite because it's so incredibly practical. The ownership pause. Before you take a significant action, especially one you know deep down you might regret, you force a pause and quietly acknowledge, this action is mine. I will live with its results.
And notice what is absent there. It's not a threat. It doesn't say, you are bad if you do this. It is just a steadying reminder of your own agency.
It's like an electrical circuit breaker in a house. The circuit breaker doesn't sit there judging the electricity. It doesn't have an opinion on the wiring.
Right.
When the system gets overloaded, it just trips the switch and stops the house from burning down. The ownership pause gives your nervous system a second to reset before the spark actually catches.
That is a highly accurate analogy. And what is so validating about all of these concepts, from the pillars to the protocols, is that this ancient wisdom is entirely supported by modern science.
This is a part that really fascinated me. the bridge between thousands of years of contemplative practice and what we are currently seeing in modern brain scans.
Let's look at the neuroscience. We can point to the work of neuroscientist Carl Friston regarding something called predictive coding. Modern neuroscience tells us the brain is essentially a prediction machine. It constantly generates these complex internal models about what is going to happen next, and then compares those expectations with incoming reality.
And when reality doesn't match the expectation, what happens physically in the brain?
It registers a prediction error, and the brain experiences this mismatch as stress. It spikes cortisol, it puts you on edge. The brain basically demands that reality match its map.
Right, the dissonance again.
Exactly. Skillful perspective is, in neurological terms, the act of updating your internal model to reduce that mismatch. By accepting impermanence and conditions, you are teaching your brain to expect reality as it actually is, which dramatically lowers the physical stress response.
It's incredible how that parallels modern psychology, too. If you look at cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and Dr. Aaron Beck's foundational work on cognitive distortions, CBT is built on the exact same insight. Our interpretation of events is what shapes our emotions and behaviors.
Yes. If you change the interpretation, you literally rewire the behavior. If you replace an automatic, catastrophizing thought with a balanced, evidence-based observation, you actually change how your body reacts to the stressor.
And we can trace this lineage back even further, straight into classical philosophy. The Stoic philosopher Epictetus famously said, "Men are disturbed not by things, but by the principles and notions which they form concerning things."
It is the narrative that causes the suffering. It's not just the physical pain of a situation, it's the story we layer over it. Like, I shouldn't be feeling this. This isn't fair. This always happens to me. That narrative is the dissonance.
Which brings us right back to Gautama.
Exactly. In ancient discourses, specifically one known as the Samadehi Sutta, which is a foundational teaching on how we form our views of reality, Gautama outlines how this middle way avoids two major psychological traps.
But let's define that sutta and those traps for anyone unfamiliar.
It is essentially a guide to right understanding. It warns against two extremes. The first is nihilism, the belief that nothing matters, actions have no consequences, and we should just give up.
Okay.
The second extreme is eternalism, the belief that everything is fixed, permanent, and rigid. Skillful perspective walks the middle path. It finds a solid, workable footing in the reality of cause, condition, and change.
So what does this all mean for us navigating our own messy lives? If we zoom all the way out, the ultimate takeaway here is that skillful perspective is simply about dropping the friction with reality. We don't have to like the map. The map might show us navigating through a massive storm, facing an incredibly difficult chapter of life.
Yes.
But we must read the map honestly. If we pretend the storm isn't there, or if we exhaust ourselves getting mad at the sky for raining, we're going to sink the raft.
That is the essence of it. Direction is built from the next honest adjustment, not from demanding perfect weather.
As we wrap up, we want to make sure you know where to find all of this material. Everything we've unpacked today comes from the RAFT to Freedom Workbook, which is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
And the truly wonderful thing is their commitment to accessibility. They are making the entire 66-chapter program freely available online. You can explore all of these concepts, tools, and daily protocols for yourself by visiting rafttofreedom.org.
Now, I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on, building on everything we've just discussed. We talked a lot about accepting the map, stopping the fight with the reality, and acknowledging the storm exactly as it is. But here is the paradox. If you stop fighting the map and accept your current coordinates, does that mean you are giving up on finding a better destination?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah, I want you to really think about this. Where do you currently feel a conflict between what you want reality to be and what it actually is? Think about the profound difference between accepting where you currently are and accepting where you are going to stay.
A perfect distinction to end on. As the chapter closes, it leaves us with this reminder. We don't see things as they are, we see them as we are. Anais Nin.